This is Beyond the Divide, traversing the experiences in the world of disability. I'm Harrison Kirkwood, your host for this podcast series, produced by Singleton Council and proudly supported by the New South Wales State Government. My guest today is Eileen King. Eileen has had many strings to her bow over her lifetime, from impressive creative writing for personal pleasure to being a piano teacher to being a shorthand writer in the courtroom for her working life. Hi, Eileen. How are you going?
Okay. Thanks, Harry.
Thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
So, Eileen, can we start with your childhood, where you grew up and what that was like?
I grew up in suburban Sydney during World War II, which I didn't really know much about because being a child. But things were sort of not available. So it wasn't like it is now where people can go out and if they've got the money, they can buy what they want. Things just weren't available. So everyone was in the same boat, so you didn't feel deprived. And my school, primary schooling was during that period. And then I went to a high school. There weren't high schools in every area then in Sydney. They were district schools. And I went to, I grew up in Kingsgrove, which is a suburb of Sydney in the St. George area. And for high school, I went to St. George Girls High School, which was at Cogra, and used to travel on two trains to get there.
And what was school like? Did you enjoy school?
I think it was just a matter of that's what you did. Rather than enjoy it.
Yeah.
You just did. I was a goody-goody. I didn't cause the teachers any problems.
I don't know.
Because they were a lot more strict back in those days and they'd give the cane.
Yeah.
So I did what I was told and was no problem.
Did you have any siblings? Did you go to school with any siblings?
I had a sister who was a year younger, so she came along after me, and I had an older brother who was 6 years older, so he more or less passed through to high school before I got to primary school.
So when you're at school, did you know what you might like to do for your working life, or did you sort of discover it by chance?
No, I didn't have any idea. Back then, it seemed to be that for girls, the only aspiration was to get married and have children and be a housewife. You didn't think about what you could do in high school, for instance, when it was getting close to that time. There weren't many occupations available. You could do nursing, work as a shop assistant, work in a factory, work in an office, and that was about it.
What was your first main job after school?
It was a very good time to get work. I think after there's been a war, I think there's a boom time. I think that's an economic fact. So it was a good time. The New South Wales State Public Service Board came around to the school and you had to pass an entrance test and they would employ you. So I did that. And not only did they employ you, but they employed you. I worked at the Housing Commission and they sent you to tech 4 half-days a week to learn shorthand and typing during working hours.
Mm-hmm.
Plus you got a weekly wage.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'd never really had much money because of circumstances. And so to be paid and to get out of work to go to tech
was all pretty good. Deal.
Yeah. So that was the first year. And then I went into a typing pool where I was doing shorthand and typing. You'd get sent out to different sections of the Housing Commission where someone wanted a stenographer. So I did that for about 6 years. And then I heard through a workmate about court reporting, and the wages were phenomenal. And I thought, gee, I'm going to do that. I must have been very financially driven. Mm-hmm. And you had to, of course, pass a certain speed to get into court reporting, which was 130 words a minute shorthand.
Wow.
And a certain speed in typing. So I did. I passed that. And then I was on a very high wage. And I was there for 4 years in state court reporting. Then one of my workmates went to Commonwealth Court Reporting. That was the Commonwealth Government, as a casual. And the wages for 3 days casual were as much as I was getting 5 days full time.
Wow.
So I thought, gee, I'm going to do that. Because by this time, no, I wasn't married then, but I just was... I'd been working full-time for 10 years because back then you usually started working at 15.
Mm.
And so I was a bit tired of working full-time. And so I applied for this for a casual court reporting, and once again you had to do another test. And so then I was with Commonwealth Court Reporting from 1962 until I came up here in 1984, till I came to Singleton in 1984.
So your time in Commonwealth Court Reporting, did you travel interstate? Or?
I did. Of course, by this time I was married and I did have children, two sons, and I did travel interstate, although I didn't particularly want to do that. But, yeah, we went to the Melbourne office and Canberra and Adelaide I went to once, and there were other trips. There was a trip which I didn't get to do to Norfolk Island. And so...
Sounds like you were able to spread your wings and travel around a little bit.
You could if you wanted to. There were those who liked doing it. I was a bit of a stay in one place person. So, I didn't particularly want to do that.
No. Did you enjoy your time in the court reporting?
I did. It was challenging. You required a lot of concentration because you're taking down every word that everyone is saying during the court proceedings. And sometimes the barrister, for instance, would lose his train of thought and he'd ask you to read back a bit so he could pick up his train of thought. And that was a bit nerve-wracking.
Mm.
You're thinking, gee, I hope I can.
Yeah.
And then we'd go back and initially we would dictate that to a typist and they would type it. And then later we used cassette recorders and we dictate into a cassette recorder and that would go to a typing area.
Right. So are there any moments in your career as a court reporter, shorthand writer, that stick out to you as sort of interesting or a bit humorous or a significant case in the courtroom?
It was a bit frustrating in that you didn't stay in for the whole case. At Commonwealth, well, you did for the state court reporting. For Commonwealth, they'd put 4 court reporters on a case, say, and you'd go in for a quarter of an hour and then someone would come and relieve you and you'd go back and dictate your bit to a typist.
Wow.
So you only got part of it. So, and a lot of the work in the Commonwealth court weren't the interesting cases. They were the ones in the district courts, in the state court reporting. Mm. In the Commonwealth, you did a lot of industrial arbitration, federal court, which was a lot of legal argument, High Court, which was a lot of legal argument, whether Section 26A means this or whether it means that. So they weren't terribly interesting as such in the area I worked in.
And while you're doing your job in the courtroom, how much was your quality of vision impacting your work at that point in time?
Well, look, it's really amazing when I think of it. I wasn't diagnosed till I was 34, so I didn't really know. I didn't have peripheral vision. I thought I could see everything there was to be seen. And I had good central vision. So to do the work I was doing, which was writing in a shorthand pad, close, with central vision, was perfect for my eye condition.
And when did your vision really start to decline, or you noticed that it was actually sort of shaping your and impacting your life?
Looking back, without me realising it, it was declining during teenage years. I could never see in the dark. That didn't become a problem while I was going out with Mum and Dad. But it was only when I was going out as a teenager that I seemed to have difficulty where others didn't. And I would knock things over like a glass of drink. And I can remember going out with a group of friends, and we went to this hotel in Sydney. We were having dinner, and the waiter was leading the way, and then I was leading the way, and then there was one step down to a different level, and I didn't see it, and I fell down. And without realising it, I wasn't diagnosed at that time. From then on, I never led any group of people anywhere. I held back. I just knew something. It's funny. It's sort of, you just know, you realise there's a problem of some sort. Why did I fall down that step?
Yeah.
And I think I put a lot of it to clumsiness.
Yeah.
And so I was, when I was diagnosed, I was actually driving for a little while, but I never felt, I felt the same there. I felt lacking in confidence and nervous.
Yeah.
And back in those days, the rules were you gave way on your right, and I had a couple of near misses. And I used to think, how come these teenagers can do all these things in the car and I'm so nervous? But it was because I didn't have any peripheral vision, and I could only see where I was looking.
So it was only a sort of a few years after you were diagnosed, roughly, that you came to Singleton, would you say?
No, I came to that was 34 I was diagnosed. I came to Singleton when I was 48.
Okay.
So I was still working at Commonwealth Court reporting. But I knew I had to start being careful. For instance, I used to jaywalk across roads. I wouldn't go to traffic lights. I'd want to take the shortest route. Even when I came here at 48, 14 years after being diagnosed, I wouldn't want to go to the pedestrian crossings. I'd cross in between. So it took me a long time to get used to the fact that I couldn't do that, or I shouldn't be doing that.
What brought you to Singleton?
I'd had this long yearning to live in the country. I don't really know where that came from. But then I had friends up here, and I was visiting one time, and they were out of town on 400 acres, and they were selling off their acreage in portions. They were only keeping a small amount. So I thought, well, here's my opportunity. I'll have someone to help me settle in. And it was just something I really wanted to do. I think people thought I was a bit crazy, people I knew. They were concerned for me. But I just knew I wanted to do that.
Are you pleased you did it on reflection?
I am. I was really highly motivated, and I am pleased I did it. I'd hate to live in Sydney now.
What do you like about living in the country?
Not so many people. And you get to know people. like, even though I'm not out and about much now, I was at the library for a short time this morning, an hour and a half, and three different people came up that I knew to talk to me. And because as a blind person, you don't know who's around you and you can't go up and talk to them.
Did you notice any difference in how people with disabilities were seen or supported in Sydney compared to when you moved to Singleton in a more rural area?
Well, in Sydney, I did everything I could to hide my disability because I had my job to think of. So I did everything I could to hide it. And I didn't even really consider I had a disability. It was just that I couldn't see some things. There were lots of things I could do. There were some things I couldn't do. So I didn't consider I had a disability. And because it was so gradual, it was easy to think like that. Because I just gradually accommodated to the slowly deteriorating vision.
And what's your vision and life like today?
Well, I can't see now. I can see light. Not even shapes sometimes. If I know people, I can't actually see you across the table. So there's definitely no useful vision.
No. I know from my own experience, adjusting and managing and getting by, it's hard in a sighted world. It's not very easy.
Look, I tend to get a bit angry. Sighted people have no idea.
No.
And even my son, who gives me a lot of support, he comes once every 6 weeks or so, and he understands a lot, but even he doesn't. He's grown up with me.
Yeah.
And always been aware that I couldn't see, but even he doesn't fully understand.
Yeah.
Because when you see, when you have sight, you just see automatically.
Yeah.
You don't have to try to see. You just see.
Yeah.
And so people don't get it.
No. You don't know what you have until you lose it, I suppose.
No, that's true. And it is a sighted world. Everything's built around having sight, the same as everything now in our society assumes you have a car.
Yeah.
And that's another disability again, because you can't get yourself around.
Is there something that you would think would help the vision impaired people as a whole? If there was one thing that would help vision impaired people, what do you think that would be? Do you know?
I'm not very hopeful. I know there are people who are blind who get along very well. I guess because I'm now elderly and I've had reasonable sight for most of my life, I feel pretty hopeless that things will... And I know I'm pessimistic, and I know there are others who are much more optimistic, but I guess I'm thinking from my personal point of view.
Yeah.
And there are so many things now. Well, there's very little I can do.
Yeah. It is a challenging situation, and the adjustment to living without sight, and, you know, even if it's more in the second part of your life, that adds another layer to it. And it's a diverse experience for anyone with vision loss. Some people have no vision to begin with.
That's from birth. Right.
Other people lose it later on. Some people, medical treatment can restore it at a point in time in their life. You know, some people live in the city and have access to specialised intervention that's a 5-minute drive around the corner. And other people, you know, are several hours away from that specialised support in the city. So they all shape and transform an individual's life in very different way.
And this comes into with rural people being disadvantaged just by not having these facilities available close by.
Yeah. Do you have a hope for people who are, say, traditionally marginalised or segregated in society? What do you hope for people who are mostly left behind?
I've come across some really nice people, but you're dependent on them making approaches to you and including you. And then there are a whole lot of other things you're really excluded from because you can't get yourself around. And I don't really get to do the things I would like to do, partly because I don't have transport, and otherwise because I can't see to participate.
Mm.
And I have traditionally liked participating in groups of various sorts, like the writing group, and I went to ballroom dancing classes a while back, and when I could see a bit better than I can now.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the participation with people who are like-minded.
Yeah. Do you think in some ways as people with disability, we have more in common with people without disabilities than we do have differences?
Well,
in some kind of way?
Well, I seem to want to do the things that interest me are things that sighted people do.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you have to have a different way to do it.
Go places, for instance. I've met someone in recent times at the dog park of all places, and we just have similar interests. And I know she goes to things that are on down at the Maitland Art Gallery, and she was telling me about a musical performance she went to. And I would love to be able to get to things like that. I have been to a couple of things at the Singleton Library. But once again, I'm dependent on the service provider for transport. And with the service providers, you have to give them 1 or 2 weeks' notice. You can't decide at the last moment to go and do something. You've got to make these arrangements ahead.
Mm. The freedom and independence to spontaneously choose is a lesson to come out of our conversation for, you know, people without disabilities to be aware and more educated on one of the challenges that people with disabilities face, I guess. And, you know, the journey that we all go on as individuals and how we need to continually to progress for a more inclusive and accessible community.
It's very isolating, I'm finding, and I presume that's how it is for people with any sort of disability. I have a granddaughter who has peripheral neuropathy. She's can't walk very far. She's only 26 and she has to use a walker. And so she's very limited in what she can do. So no matter what the disability, it's very limiting.
Mm. Yes, I agree and can appreciate and empathise with those kind of challenges. I guess there are many things taken for granted, as our conversation has revealed today. And I just, I guess, hope from a medical standpoint that changes and new discoveries can be made so there is more hope for people with disability, because those challenges are still there, sometimes in different forms to generations gone by, but eventually, hopefully, help people with disabilities live a more connected and less challenged life in some ways. Thanks for joining me, Eileen. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast today and hearing some of your insights.
Thank you for asking me, Harry.